Anyway, Gershon back with you on the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs. Pleased to be joined by Greg Pryor, former Royals baseball player, member of the 1985 World Series champions. And we had a chance to meet Greg during our Royals bus trip there at the K on Sunday, a game the Royals won in extra innings. Greg was a good luck charm, and that nice 1985 World Series ring, that looked pretty sharp on his hand as well. He is with us today on the Sports Ticket. Greg, how you doing? And thanks for your time today.
Hey, Wade, it's great to be here, and it's great to talk to the Royals fans in parts of the Kansas that I don't get too often, but I'm so glad that the Royals fans are out there and love baseball.
Well, let's get a little bit of background for folks out there that may or may not be familiar with you. First of all, you played in the major leagues for 10 seasons, correct?
Well, actually, it was between 9 and 10. I got called up in 1976 by the Texas Rangers, my first time in the big leagues. After I spent 6 years in the minor leagues making peanuts, I got a chance to see if I could play in the big leagues in 76, part of a year. And then I went on to play nine full seasons, four with the White Sox up in on the south side in Chicago. And then I got traded here in 1982, and I played 5 years with the Royals. So between 9 and 10.
Who was involved in the transaction in the trade where you went to the Royals?
Well, you know, it's weird, and that's a great question because, you know, you always wonder if you're ever going to get traded or if anybody still wants you. And the White Sox told me going into spring training that they weren't going to keep me for the 82 season. So I go to spring training knowing that there's a bullseye on my back. And then luckily for me, the Royals were then training in Fort Myers, Florida, and the White Sox were in Sarasota. So I got to play against the Royals quite a bit in the spring training games. And the last week of spring training in 82, there were two infielders that got broken bones in their hands for the Royals, Onyx Concepcion and a guy named Tim Ireland. And the Royals were desperate to get an infielder, and it was only because I had the unfortunate breakage of hands of these Royals that I got traded to Kansas City. And I was traded for a relief pitcher named Jeff Schattinger, who never made it to the big league. So I kind of feel like the Royals got the best end of the deal.
Absolutely. Now, you live in Kansas City, Overland Park area. Is that right now?
Yeah, we moved here after I got traded to the team I didn't like. You know, in 82, I didn't like the Royals too much. But after I got traded to them, I liked them a whole lot. And then we stayed here in Overland Park. We had three daughters that went to elementary, middle school, high school. And then they all graduated from KU. And so we just can't get out of here. It's a wonderful place to live, and we're so glad we live in Kansas.
When you were growing up, and we're speaking with Greg Pryor, former Royal, a part of the 85 World Series championship team, he's joining us today on the Sports Ticket. When you were growing up, and you met my son, he's 9, he's playing baseball right now. When you were growing up, was that always a goal to make it to the big leagues, or was that something that maybe was a little bit unexpected? Were you a early bloomer, a late bloomer? Kind of take me through, as you were growing up, what your goals were and how you got to the bigs.
Well, my mom and dad were from West Virginia. They were both presidents of their glee clubs. Remember when glee clubs were the real glee clubs?
Uh-huh.
And they had six children, five boys and a girl. I grew up in a school teacher's home. My dad taught math, and he coached high school sports. So I certainly learned how to play sports and math because of my dad. And then, you know, when I graduated from high school in 1967, I was not drafted by the pros, and I had no scholarship offers to college. And I certainly didn't have any plans on playing any pro ball at that time as a senior in high school. No dreams, it wasn't even a realm of possibility. And then my older brother was a really, really good pitcher, and he got a four-year scholarship to a college in Florida called Florida Southern. And he went 8-0 his freshman year, and I was a senior in high school. So my dad went to the college coach, and he said, look, he says, if you don't take my younger son and give him a scholarship, I'm going to take my older son out of your school. And so I go to school on a bribe, right, Wade? My dad bribed the coach. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know it until after I graduated. So here I go to college. I got a small scholarship, very small. And for the first 2 years, I hit eighth or ninth on my college team. So they even then, in college, I had no desire, or not. It wasn't a desire. It wasn't even a realm of possibility that I would even be good enough to play in the pros. But I was small in life. I graduated from high school at 5'6", 150 pounds. But I started growing a little bit in college, and I started getting this work ethic about, you know, working your tail off and you can get better. So I just started working hard, hitting balls and trying to get stronger and trying to keep up with the competition. And then all of a sudden I became an All-American my junior year, and my senior year I got drafted by the Washington Senators in 71. I got $10,000 to sign. I went out and bought a used Camaro for my first car. And then you know, I played 6 years in minor leagues, just getting a little bit better each year. And all of a sudden here I get a chance to play in the big league. So yeah, I went from not really having a dream to you know, living a dream.
What position were you playing in college? Because in the big leagues, you certainly you could play various positions, more of a utility infielder. I know you could play pretty much any position on the infield, but what primary position did you play in college?
Well, I played second base, and only because I wasn't very fast, and I wasn't a great fielder in college, or even in the minor leagues, I wasn't a very good fielder. So the college coach, I could hit a little bit, you know. And so I played second base in college, but I always wanted to play shortstop, so I worked so hard to get my feet quicker and get stronger that I played a lot of games in the shortstop in the major league. So even though I played second in college, I played a lot more a short third in the big leagues.
Greg Pryor, a member of the Kansas City Royals 1985 World Series championship team, is with us today on the Sports Ticket. So Greg, let's go back to that that magical year of 1985. Certainly Royals had better seasons during the regular season, probably were more of a favorite going to the playoffs. They broke through in 1980 and finally knocked off the Yankees, and then they go to the World Series and lose in six games to the Phillies. And you were a part of the team in 84 that got swept by the Tigers and made the playoffs. So take me into kind of the psyche in the clubhouse. After 84 ended, did you feel like, okay, we got a taste of this, and now we'll be back in 1985?
Well, let me jump back just a little bit before that to 82 when I got traded to the Royals. We had Amos Otis here. We had George Brett, Frank White, Quisenberry, Willie Wilson, you know. And those guys had been through some wars with the Yankees in the late 70s. There were some great, great playoff games, and the Royals had been in the playoffs. So when I got traded here in 82, Amos Otis took me aside, and he goes, Pryor, a little bit different here in Kansas City. We're expected to win. And that's all he said to me. And it was like, oh, my goodness, you know. I'd spent 4 years in the big leagues. I was semi-bona fide. I played 140-some games in 1979 in the big leagues. So, you know, I was proven that I could play in the big leagues. But now when you get to the Royals, they expect you to win. Well, when I got around that atmosphere of the pain and suffering that some of those guys had experienced at the hands of the Yankees back in the late 70s, you know, I felt like I was a rookie when I got traded here. So, you know, when we won the division in 84, as you said, and then we played the Tigers in the playoffs. They beat us 3-0 to go to the World Series, where they beat the Padres. And then it almost felt like after we lost that third game to the Tigers in Tiger Stadium, it was unfinished business. Certainly for me, because I was still, you know, young enough to be aggravated because you come so close to getting the World Series and you don't. So it was a carryover to 85, and then we got some young pitching in, and I think some of your listeners will know the name Brett Saberhagen, the name Danny Jackson, the name Charlie Liebrand. Yeah, they'll remember those guys, Buddy Black, guys like that. And that pitching carried Mark Gubazov. That pitching carried us over to the chance to play in the playoffs in 85. We got down 3-1 to the Blue Jays in the American League Championship, and then we knocked them out 3 straight games to play the Cardinals in the World Series. We got down 3-1 to them, and we beat them in St. Louis, brought it back to Kansas City, and then, as everybody knows, the Royals won the last 2 games of the 85 World Series, and then we were the last team standing. And it's so much fun to talk about. It seems like it was yesterday, even though it was over 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's probably hard to believe it's been that long ago. We're talking to Greg Pryor. He's our guest today on the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs. So let's go back to 1985 in the playoffs there. You mentioned the Blue Jays. You guys are down 3-1. We hear so many times after the fact that, well, we always believed. We never doubted it. Well, we can doubt sometimes players, if they're totally being honest, it probably crept into the back of some people's minds. Man, we're down 3-1. We have to win 3 games to keep our season alive and go to the World Series. What was the confidence level like? What was the feeling in the clubhouse after you guys were down 3-1? And didn't you have to go to Toronto down 3-1? Is that right for Game 5?
Yeah, we did, and, you know, there was some thought. You know, you just feel it. We didn't sit around and talk about it, but it's like, why do we need to fly to Canada? Why don't we just give it to the Blue Jays here? But the attitude of that team, you know, we had a guy named Jim Sundberg behind the plate. Lonnie Smith was on the team then, and we had a wonderful defensive lineup, and we could hit. We had Balboni at first, who hit 36 home runs. It's still a Royals record. He had 36 home runs in 85. So we had some pop, we had some defense, but what we had is what makes baseball one of the greatest games ever invented, and in my opinion, the best team sport ever invented anywhere, and that includes soccer and basketball, football, hockey, all the rest, is that the defense controls the action. In baseball, the defense controls the action. And by the word defense, I mean this. If you have a pitcher that starts the action by throwing the ball to the offensive team, and your pitcher has got the heart of a lion like Danny Jackson had, you know, to get us even on that plane to Toronto, it inspires the whole team. We had pitching which is defense, that was better than Toronto, and it was better than St. Louis, and that's why those teams couldn't handle it, because our starting pitching shut them down. And if I was going to start a team today, it would be with my starting pitching. And I would go defense next, and offense would be last. So I'd say our starting pitching was the reason why we were able to survive against Toronto. We certainly going up there and knowing we had to win two games in a row wasn't an easy task, but, you know, it was we did it, you know. It's just part of history.
George Brett, talk about him, because I'm sure many people, you know, whether you're older or younger Royals fans, you know all about George Brett. And he was the ALCS MVP in that 85 series against the Blue Jays. And I remember, I was 9 at the time, I remember watching, and just every time Brett came up, I was hoping or expecting him to hit home run. And I know what he did against Doyle Alexander, and he was tremendous in that ALCS. But I guarantee you, people are listening right now to our station, our Royals fans, want to know, what was it like working with and playing with George Brett, and what kind of competitor he was?
Well, I got traded to the Royals in 82. I showed up in the clubhouse the next day. I drove down from Sarasota to Fort Myers. And so here I am walking into the clubhouse where I really didn't like the Royals at that time. It's kind of funny to say it, but it's true. The Royals were so good. They were so cocky. And I was a White Sox, and I mean, we had a lot of battles against them. So here I am, traded to the enemy almost. So I go to the clubhouse, and the equipment manager runs over, and he says, "Pryor, I need to get a number for your jersey for Baltimore. We're opening up in a week against the Orioles in Baltimore." So I told him, I said, "Hey, I don't care. I'll take any number." I wasn't a numbers guy. Well, Jamie Quirk, who was on the team, he and I knew each other from playing in winter ball together, and he runs over, and he goes, "Pryor," he says, "take number 4. I said, "Why?" He goes, "Your locker next to George Brett." I said, "Okay, give me number 4. And I hadn't even met George at the time. Because when George got on second base or third base, when he was running the bases, I never even talked to him. So I never knew him until that day. And I walked up to him, and I said, "Hey," I said, "I'm Greg Pryor. I got traded." And I said, "Yeah," he said, "I know you." He said, how come you never talked to me when I was on the base when we played you guys for 4 years? I said, "George, I didn't like you at all." I said, I didn't want to talk to you. I didn't want to be friendly with you. And he goes, he started laughing. He goes, "You like me now?" I said, "I hope so." He said, "Yeah," I said, "I love you now." So anyway, you know, I lockered next to him at the Pine Tar game in Yankee Stadium. I was lucky enough, or unlucky enough, to have a locker next to him, because after that Pine Tar game, with my number being next to his in the locker room, they had like 50 reporters around my locker. I couldn't even get dressed. So there was some problems of locker next to him. But overall, he was one of the most amazing hitters that I'd ever played with. You know, I played with against a lot of World Series and Hall of Fame guys like Rod Carew and Dave Winfield and Wade Boggs and you know, those guys. But George, watching him day to day was just such a thrill, and he inspired the rest of us to you know, get good at bats and try to drive in runs, accountable for you know, getting the runner in from third with one out. But the game that I think you're referring to back in that Toronto series was that game where George hit a couple home runs, and then that was our first win in the playoffs against the Blue Jays. I think we were down 2-0 when George had that great game. And you know, it's funny about that, how thoughtful George is at times. Dick Houser was our manager at that time, and he had lost like 8 or 9 straight playoff games, a bunch with the Yankees, and then, you know, a bunch with the Royals. And he was like 0-9 in the playoffs, and that was Dick Houser's first postseason victory. And when George caught the last out on a pop-up to win the game, he brought the ball over. I was right watching him. He brought it over, and he handed it to Dick, and he said, "Dick, this you get the game ball. This is your first playoff victory." So, you know, it was so much fun to be around George. He inspired me to be a better player, and I think that I inspired him to be a better player too.
Talking to Greg Pryor, he's our guest today on the Sports Ticket. You mentioned the Pine Tar game, so I want to go back to that because that was a weird, really, really weird situation. You can fill in the fans on this because, of course, Brett went berserk after they had called him out after they had measured the pine tar in his bat there at Yankee Stadium. And, well, first of all, did you think George Brett was going to kill an umpire? Because when he comes flying out of that dugout, he looked like a man possessed. I mean, what was going through some of your guys' minds when he went berserk?
Well, it's great, and I love talking about it because I have T-shirts with the box score on the back. You know, they was so an amazing event that they made T-shirts because of the event. But, you know, for the fans that really don't understand what the Pine Tar game is about, let me just explain real quickly, and I'll get to George's tirade just a second. You know, there's a rule in baseball that says you can't have any foreign substance 18 inches from the end of your bat toward the handle. But a lot of guys, when I played, and a lot of guys now, they put pine tar or a substance on the bat that would make it a little bit more tacky and sticky so you'd get a better grip. So you'd wipe the pine tar bat, or you'd wipe the pine tar right around the label of the bat, right in the middle of it. But what George did was he would get that pine tar bat, and then to wipe some of it off, he would grab the barrel. Then you could see his fingerprints and the smudge marks up near the barrel. But he wasn't doing it to make the ball do anything better or worse. So that game, the Houser, the manager, had sent me to the bullpen as somebody to warm up one of the pitchers because we had both catchers in the game. So that was the only time in my whole life as a baseball player, a little league, college, pro, whatever, that I was ever in the bullpen. I was there one time in my life, and it was the Pine Tar game. So George hits the home run to put us up by one run in the top of the ninth in Yankee Stadium. We go up, I think it was 3-2, and then the two with two outs. And then the manager of the Yankees, Billy Martin, he grabbed the bat, and he had the umpires look at it, and he said he has pine tar on the barrel, and that's illegal, and he should be called out. Well, they laid the bat down. I think home plate's 18 inches, by the way, yep, across the front of it. And they laid the bat across home plate, and they ruled that the pine tar indeed was in the forbidden zone. And the umpire in chief, Tim McClellan, called George out with the encouragement of Joe Brinkman, who was the head umpire of the crew. And then they have videotapes, obviously. We can see them taking time. And all of a sudden, they looked over, and he put up the out sign. And George, his hat flew off. He ran out of the dugout faster than I think he's ever ran. And luckily, somebody grabbed him, or he would have knocked the umpire over, I'm sure. But he was saying things in such an angry, loud voice that I don't think the umpire could even understand it. But everybody in the world knew how upset George was. So anyway, George gets thrown out of the game. Gaylord Perry and Rocky Colavito grabbed that pine tar bat, and they tried to steal it so there'd be no evidence, you know? So they're running through the clubhouse or up into the clubhouse, and the police grabbed them with the bat. And most people don't know that. But so Rocky Colavito, Gaylord Perry got thrown out. Dick Houser got thrown out. And after the game, after the event, we walked from the bullpen across left field in Yankee Stadium. I walked in the clubhouse, and I saw George by his locker, and he was surrounded by at least 50 reporters. They were talking to him. And after they got done, I went over, and he had his head down, and I sat in front of him next to my locker, and I said, "Hey, what's the matter?" And he goes, "What do you think?" I said, "I lost the home run. We lost the pine tar game, or we lost the game." I said, "Wait, George, look at the bright spot." He says, "What bright spot?" I said, "There's going to be a pine tar company that's come to you and offer you $150,000 to endorse their pine tar. You're going to get a huge endorsement contract out of this." And he started smiling at me. He says, "That's a great idea." he says, "Where are we going to go eat?" I'm in a good mood now. But as you know, the umpire, the American League president, Lee McPhail, he overturned the rule. He said that the intent of the rule was not to punish people that I didn't do it to inflict any further length on a ball that you hit or make it go faster. He overturned the rule, which is very rare that you overturn a rule or a ruling like that, because we protested, you know, the rules protested, sure. And they upheld the protest. So we go back in like 6 weeks later. We flew to Newark. We get on the bus. George stayed in Newark to eat dinner at a restaurant there. I was the third baseman to finish the Pine Tar game at third base because there was still two out in the top of the ninth. So we had to get the Yankees out in the bottom of the ninth. We got them out. We went back in. We got our clothes back on, and then we took the bus back to Newark, flew to Baltimore.
I heard it was pretty weird, that return trip, because, like you said, you only had to play basically four outs left in the game, and there was only a few fans that were there. It had to be a little bit of an eerie feeling finishing that game.
Yeah, I think Steinbrenner sold tickets for 75 cents, as I remember, to finish the game. And there was nobody in the stands. In fact, Billy Martin protested before the game started. He walked out on the field, and he said that the first runner, I think it was UL Washington or whatever, somebody, did not touch second base, and because it was a new umpire crew. You know, the umpires that were in the first Pine Tar game were not the umpires that umpired the finish of the Pine Tar game. So Billy Martin runs out, and then luckily for the American League and the umpires, each umpire signed an affidavit in the first crew that stated that all the runners properly touched the bases so that they could not protest that a runner missed second base, because it would have been very embarrassing.
Yeah.
Had the umpires said, yeah, you're right, we don't know if they touched the bases or not, let's call this off until we find out if the guys touched the base. But that's what happened. And then we get the Yankees out, and it was eerie. They had Don Mattingly playing the second base. They had Ron Guidry playing in the outfield. I don't know why the Yankees didn't try to win that game, because it was only a one-run lead. They could have come back, but it's almost like they gave up.
Yeah.
But I was glad to get out of there, with the win. And it's so funny that Gaylord Perry created T-shirts with the Pine Tar bat box score on the bat, and he was selling the T-shirts in the Royals clubhouse for $12 a piece, and I still have a couple.
That's funny. 85 World Series. You guys are down 3-1 against St. Louis. Same thing as Toronto. You come back. You win, you get game 5 in St. Louis, you come back and you win game 6. Of course, game 6 was Cardinal fans will point out, the missed call at first base with Don Dingacher. You guys come back, you win that game. And then game 7, I remember, even at the age of nine, I remember thinking when you guys won game 6 that this thing's over. You guys are going to win game 7. How did you guys feel about that when the Cardinals kind of fell apart after game 6?
Well, again, let me jump back to 84 real quick and tell you about Danny Jackson. Danny Jackson pitched the game in Kansas City when we were down 3-1 to the Blue Jays. It was a must-win game for us. Danny Jackson did the job. It was on a Sunday afternoon. We beat Toronto, and then we go to we had to fly to Toronto, and we ended up winning 2 to even get into the series. So here we are down 3-1 to the Cardinals. We're playing in St. Louis, and guess who the starting pitcher is? Danny Jackson. And we knew that Danny was like one of the most tenacious pitchers that I've ever played with or against. And history shows that he got another World Series ring. He pitched for the Reds in a World Series. Mm-hmm. He got 2 World Series rings. But Danny beat the Cardinals in St. Louis. And then here we come back to Kansas City. Like you said, we're down 1-0 in the bottom of the ninth in the 6th game. And George Orta hit a topper to first base. First base threw it to Todd Worrell. Worrell's foot was on the base. He caught the ball before Orta hit the base. But as a umpire that can be fallible, Don Dingacher, a close friend of mine, a customer of my company still, you have to look at the glove and the foot at the same time. And then, it's easy to do that if you have 3 eyes. But, he listened for the sound of the glove or whatever, but fortunately for us, he made the wrong call,
Yeah.
Which umpires do. Which umpires do, you Cardinals fans out there that are listening? Umpires make bad calls. That didn't lose the World Series for the Cardinals. You know what lost the World Series for the Cardinals? Their team batting average was 170 for 7 games. How embarrassing would it have been for the Cardinals to be the team that won the World Series with the worst batting average ever? We saved them from that embarrassment. Anyway, we went on to get these breaks from the Cardinals after that missed call by the ump. Balboni got a new two-base hit. Jack Clark missed a pop-up that almost hit the back of his head right next to our dugout. He missed it. Nobody talks about that. They want to talk about Don Dankinger. Nobody talks about the 0-2 base hit that Balboni got. Nobody wants to talk about the pass ball that Darryl Porter had in that game, you know? So, you know, the Cardinals, they had the bullseye on their back. They choked. That's basically what happened. Because the next night, you know, they had a chance to win the seventh game.
Sure.
You know, we started 0-0. We beat them 11-0,
mm-hmm.
you know?
And they melted down.
So people want to, and poor Don Dankinger, you know, he had to get a police escort to his home in Des Moines, Iowa. You know, people were threatening to kill him, but it wasn't him. It was a human being that made a mistake. He didn't cost the World Series to the Cardinals. The Cardinals lost the World Series because they just weren't good enough. That's why they lost.
If I remember correctly, Orta was out either on a force out or you guys tried to bunt him. I can't remember what happened, but Orta ended up being out shortly after that anyway as the lead runner.
Yeah. It was man on first and second with nobody out, and Sundberg was up to bunt. He bunted to third. Worrell threw the ball to third, and they forced Orta out at third. So we still had men on first and second with one out, you know,
right.
Even though Sundberg didn't sacrifice them over. And then that's when the pass ball happened.
Yep.
The pass ball happened. They intentionally walked Hal McCray with the bases loaded, and Dane Orge got the base hit to score. He got a base hit to score Buddy Biancolana and
Sundberg.
Also Onyx Conception, or Sundberg.
Yeah, Sundberg had the slide. That's right. And then, of course, Game 7, you roll them.
Yeah. We killed them in Game 7. But, you know, it's funny. I'm writing a book. I've got grandchildren. I'm writing a book of these stories that these fans are listening to, and I appreciate them still listening. Hopefully, they're enjoying their day. I've got like 50 stories, kind of like what you're asking me, that I'm putting in a book, and someday I'm going to publish it because I got grandkids that need to hear these stories, and I don't think they're listening to the radio show in Phoenix, Arizona, right now. But you know, I need to write them down, so I'm going to write these stories down and publish them somewhere.
That'd be awesome. Definitely would be worthwhile reading material. So you guys win the World Series in '85, a tremendous high, and you had the big parade and everything. And I was talking with you about this the other day because, of course, 30 years later, after '85, last year, 2015, the Royals win the World Series and big parade and the toast of the town, like you guys, I'm sure, were in back in 1985. And there's been this moniker, I don't know if it's a myth or if there's something to it, that there's a World Series hangover. We've seen the Giants win a World Series, don't make the playoffs next year. Win the World Series, don't make the playoffs the next year. That's why I think it's impressive what the Royals did, making the World Series back-to-back years. Do you believe in that? Because you were part of that team in '86 that was coming off of winning a World Series championship in '85. Is there something to the World Series hangover, and maybe you just kind of come down a little bit after playing such exciting baseball for that long of a period of time?
Yeah, it's a good question, and you know, we wonder if that's happening right now with our current team, because you know they've been in the World Series two games in a row, and a lot of us Royals fans, we would like to do it again. Let's get back to the playoffs. But what happened in '86 is that I think that the winter was so short, because the team that wins the World Series has the least amount of time off between then and spring training. The Royals only had like 120 days off before they have to go back to surprise. They're still celebrating. They celebrated the first day of spring training this year. And unfortunately for human beings, sometimes that subconscious drive is just not as easy to stir up in your brain, because, you know, let's suppose that a guy is in the farm and he's out doing, 10 to 20 acres, and he worked on it the week to get all the land ready. He's got everything planted, and then somebody comes up to him after he's got this fantastic job done, and he goes, okay, you need to start on the 10 acres tomorrow morning. You know, that's basically what happens in baseball. There's no rest, because as soon as the season was over, when I played, I started getting ready for the next season. I started working out. So as a team, when you win a World Series like we did, and we got back to spring training in '86, I think that the subconscious drive that we had, there was something missing about it. We just couldn't get it done because, there's other teams that want to knock you off. And when you win a World Series, you know, if you play against these teams that weren't in it, obviously, you know, they want to knock you off. So it's compounded, and I think that there is a backlog or a backlash of success of being punished for being successful. But you look back in history, you know, those old Yankee teams, they won the World Series year after year.
Yeah.
But that was different back then, and let me tell you why. Back then, there was no union, and your contract was basically year to year. They didn't give multi-year contracts back when the Yankees won the World Series. So, you know, if you hit 330 one year and you hit 320 the next year, back in the old days, they cut your salary. So back in the old days, there was more desire for guys to play better every year there is now. Not to say that guys don't try, but sometimes some coaches won't let you.
This year, or I should say last year's team, and of course the 2014 team as well, seemed to have tremendous chemistry. We heard Ned Yost talk about how everybody's pulling for one another. Keep the line moving was the phrase that they mentioned quite a bit last year. When I was speaking with you in the stands the other day, Sunday at the Royals game, you had told me that the 85 team, you guys might not have been the best Royals team ever, but what you had that nobody can quantify is a camaraderie and a chemistry. And did you see the same thing with the Royals team from the last couple of years?
Yeah, well, like any World Series team, you know, you're going to have, it's very difficult to be around 25 guys for seven straight months and get along with each other. Very difficult. The personalities and egos are so different. It's not easy. On the 85 team, we got along, and when we got between the lines, we were able to take our personalities and leave them off the field. You know, we didn't take our personalities on the field. We knew when a guy wasn't hustling. We knew when a guy didn't try to take the extra base. We knew when a guy didn't get a run in from third base with one out. You know, that was, and we didn't want to be the guy that did that. That's, we didn't have any rules. It wasn't written down. It says, hey, run them out, guys. Hey, guys, come on. We had the inspiration to do it and get the job done. But the thing that I really liked on the Royals in 2014 and 2015 was the way that a very, very quiet kind of a guy in Alex Gordon, the boisterous, most friendly guy I've ever seen on the baseball field in Salvador Perez. And then you got Moustakas and Hosmer, who played together in the minor leagues and who've been on winning teams in the minor leagues together. You mix those four guys in. I say those four guys because I think they are the they were the core of what happened, because then we went out and got Escobar and Kane for Zach Greinke. You got six guys, mm-hmm. and then you get some good pitching and good relieving by accident. Wade Davis, we never thought Wade Davis was going to do what he's done. Right. We never thought the reliever before Davis, Hubbard, what was the
Greg Holland?
Holland. You know, those were accidents that happened, and I think all those guys had that humble, let's win first and let's be egomaniac second attitude. And that's why the Royals were able to do what they did, given the fact that they knew how to pitch, they knew how to defend, and they learned how to hit with two strikes. I mean, the last year's Royals team, I mean, there've been a lot of great World Series teams that I've seen, but that team, you know, that would have given our 85 team a tussle, I'm sure.
How, I guess there's probably many ways to answer this question, so maybe we just pinpoint one area that stands out to you, but how has the game changed since 1985 when you guys won the World Series 30 years ago? I mean, because we have replay now, of course the money is much bigger now than it was then in regards to contracts and guaranteed contracts. They're not year to year now. The other thing that stands out to me is a lot of specialization. I mean, Wade Davis is going to pitch the ninth. Herrera is going to pitch the eighth. Goose Gossage back in the day in Quisenberry would pitch 2-3 innings to get a save. What stands out to you about what's the most different part of the game from 85 to now?
Well, you know, if we had another hour, we could probably talk an hour about how the game has changed
right.
over the years, because it's not I don't want to give just a thimbleful of information. Maybe we could schedule a call later in the season.
Sure.
But basically what I see as the differences in the game is, number one, the care for the ball player that people really don't see. When the Royals got their World Series rings, they announced the names of the players. I was there when they got their rings, the second game of the season this year. And out trots the exercise trainer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I played, we didn't have an exercise. The physical fitness trainer got a World Series ring. When I played, our trainer barely knew how to rub a bicep. He didn't know anything about stretching hardly. Okay. And then the next guy that they announced, and our massage therapist, Bart.
Yeah.
Bart Bengay. Come out and get your World Series ring.
Right.
Massage therapist gets a World Series ring?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. We didn't know what massage was back in 1985. Okay. So, you know, I'm just giving you two small examples
sure.
of a huge list of examples. Back in 85, we never had a weight training room. Back now, you go down there, and guys are working out on the weights before and after the ball game. We didn't know anything about working out on the weights to get stronger, to be more durable. And then, you know, one thing I really don't like at all is, and it's a small thing, is when the pitcher throws the ball in the dirt at home plate, you know what they do? They throw the ball out of the game.
Yep.
That makes me so sad, because back when I played, and I caught a third base at third base in Old Comiskey Park, and I looked at the ball. We're getting ready to come up and hit. I looked at the ball all the time, and it was so dirty, I rolled it back to the mound. I didn't call the umpire and say, hey, we need a clean ball. If I was the first hitter in the bottom of the inning at Comiskey Park, and I caught that ball, and I rolled it back to the mound, well, the pitcher would come out, and he would throw that dirty ball for 7 or 8 or 9 pitches to get ready to face me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So right before he threw his first pitch to me, I called timeout. I'd back up, and I'd look at the umpire, and I'd say, hey, can you check that dirty ball for me, please? Back in the old days, you used to be able to check balls. You forced the umpire to check the ball, see if there was something wrong with it. Well, as soon as the pitcher would throw the ball in, the catcher would grab it, I'd be standing right next to the umpire looking at it with him. And I knew it was dirty, and I knew he was going to throw it out. He'd throw it out, and a new ball went back to the pitcher, and I know the pitcher was not very happy because, you know, pitchers back in the day, they would throw balls out too. Remember back in the day when they would, like, shake a ball, they throw a ball into the catcher, and they get a new ball because
mm-hmm.
they didn't like the scene?
Yep.
That has changed. There's no new balls. Let me ask you a question. If a ball is hit on a one line, a hot shot to a shortstop, and he catches it and throws it to first, how come they don't throw that ball out of the game?
That's a good question.
Yeah, you tell me, Mr. Umpire. If I was in front of all the umpires, I'd say, look, I expect every ball to be thrown out of the game if it hits one hop to an infielder. If you're going to throw them out at home plate, then you throw them out when it's a one hop to shortstop. Throw
yeah.
them all out.
Yeah.
and the reason I don't like that rule is because it slows the game up, you know? I
yeah.
think it does. But the reason that rule was put in was to speed the game up.
Right.
And then another thing that I really don't like, I'm really coming to this realization, is this instant replay. I really, really, it's almost like I'm at a football game now. And I see those umpires go over with headsets on, and I go, you can go in and make popcorn by the time they make the decision.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring this up, because this is a very big topic right now in the last 24 to 48 hours, because the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, has said he's not happy with how things have regressed, because they did shave about 8 minutes off the game last year, and now we're up to 3 hours per game, and he's talked about the pace of play, and he's not happy with some of the long delays with the long reviews on replay as well. So I think something will be done on it.
Let me just put it this way to the fans out there, and I'm sure there's fans out there that are agreeing with me, and there's fans that say baseball's too long, but let me just say this for the fans that are listening. If you ever saw Ben-Hur, and I hope you saw the movie Ben-Hur, did you complain about how long it was? It was such a great movie.
Yeah, right.
It was one of the best movies of all time. And who's sitting around, or Dr. Zhivago, was that movie too long? No. Those movies were made long because they wanted to make them long to really make a great, great movie. And albeit, there is some time in baseball that is dead time, albeit. They ought to speed the time up between innings
yeah.
somehow.
Yeah.
And I think baseball has stood the test of time based on the way they've been playing it. And I just think that people get paid this money to speed things up when they don't. There's not a problem. Leave it alone. There's no problem with baseball. Baseball's been played that way for years and years and years. And if you just don't like the length of a baseball game, take a nap, have a hot dog, and then wake up and watch the last three innings or something.
Ed, some people do that, actually. Greg Pryor is with us, former Royals player, a member of the 85 World Series champion team. So two final questions for you, Greg. The last one is, Bryce Harper's mentioned this, and I think it's certainly different than when you played. Lots of even more diversity in baseball in regards to cultures and from various players from various countries. Some people took offense to the Jose Bautista bat flip last year in the playoffs. Some people did not. Bryce Harper has said that, you know, we need more fun in baseball. Now, Goose Gossage has been very adamant, and he's the old school guard, and he basically totally disagreed with Bryce Harper. Where do you stand on that in regards to having fun? Because, you know, the Royals have fun. They dump the Gatorade bucket even on the road when they win, which I think some people have an issue with that too. But they tend to play the game and have fun. I don't have a problem with that. I like to have my kids see the guys have fun because it is supposed to be a kid's game. It's supposed to be a game and not a job, although it certainly is a job from time to time. I understand that. But what do you think about those comments from some of the younger players about how there's all these unwritten rules and it's like, you know what, we just want to express ourselves because in a lot of other sports, you can.
Well, there's a fine line between enjoying yourselves and rubbing it in on the other team. And let's go to football. Well, you know, when football players started scoring touchdowns and then, you know, getting five guys together to spike the football, you know, in baseball, you just didn't do that. You didn't want to show the other team up. And I came up, and if you got a double, you didn't do hand signs to your dugout with every time you got a hit. That's what you're supposed to do. You know, that's what you're supposed to do. You're paid to do that. You don't need to show off, you know. And I think that there is a place for maybe throwing the Gatorade bucket or whatever they do after the game. Sometimes it gets monotonous, you mm-hmm. know. I think the fans like it. I think they like to see it. But I think it's it can get old. But there again, I think that if you hit a walk-off home run, I see nothing wrong with all the players going to home plate and throwing your helmet up in the air. Because, you know, the other team knows that you're not showing them up. But the hitters that hit something and they slip their bat like they did something special, you know, just go ahead, hit your home run, drop your bat and run around the bases. You don't need to be saying hi to all your fans in the stands or to show off for your teammates. Because what happens is if you tick the other team off, somebody's going to have to pay for it. You know, the fight that they had in Texas the other night between the second baseman and and Bautista, you know, that stuff, Major League teams get revenge. And if they think you're showing them up, they're going to get revenge on you somehow. I don't know when it's going to happen, but they will get revenge. So there's enough excitement in baseball where we don't have to rub it in the face of the other team, or we don't have to act like we're big shots and act like we did something special when all we're doing was earning the money that we're being paid to be great.
Okay, final question for you, Greg, before we let you go, and we appreciate your time. It's been awesome.
And before we quit, I'd like to tell people how they can get in touch with me on my website, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and listen, if anybody's listening on the show today, thanks for listening. If you want to know what I do for a living, write this website down, and I'll give you a deal, and if you want to order from me. Because I've been in the health and nutrition industry now for 25 years. I own my own company. You can go to my website and look at what I offer. I ship all over the country. I'll even ship to your area. It's a life priority, LifePriority.com. And if you decide you want to order something, we've got a code already for just the listeners on this show. If they put in the word America in the code, if they order online and they put in the word America, we'll give them 10% off their order, and I just wanted to throw that in, and thanks for letting me do that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We will do that, and we'll mention that again here at the very end. And now it's time for our off-the-wall question. Greg, I do this with all our guests on the Sports Ticket, something a little bit unique that might make you think. Off-the-wall question for you is, what was the best prank you were involved in when you were in the big leagues, whether you were a victim of the prank or whether you were the instigator of the prank?
Hey, can you repeat that? Because yeah. I've been an instigator my whole life.
You've been an instigator? Sure, yeah, that. Yeah. The best prank. What's the best prank you're ever involved in, whether you were the victim or whether you were the instigator when it comes to all that?
Oh, man. And my grandkids might be listening.
Yeah. You got to keep her clean. That's true, too. Yeah.
Well, one night we're out. I can't mention the player because I don't like players that cut down other players without them being around.
Sure.
But one night, we had a real famous player out. We had a car for some reason. We're in Seattle. And this famous player wanted to go to the restroom really, really, really bad. So we let him out, and instead of him trying to find a place to go, he decided to do it in the middle of the road. Well, we backed up, and we shined the lights on him. And then he didn't stop. And then we started putting the car in reverse and slow and backing up real fast. So he started running toward the car. We started going in reverse even faster. He's sprinting toward the car, and all of a sudden we put the car we put the brakes on the car. He slammed up in and hit the windshield, and then we rolled him off the front of the car.
Oh my! Oh my!
Yeah.
Was he all right?
No. All of a sudden, we're all coming to our senses, and we're thinking, "Oh my gosh, we might have broke his arm." No, he was fine, and he went on to become a really, really, really great player.
Wow. He could have ruined the guy's career, for crying out loud.
So I'm not saying that, but that was only one time.
Yeah.
There's other things we did, you know. One spring training, I went to a camp with spiked hair. I because spring training is a hot down in Florida, and I got my hair spiked, and I walked in the clubhouse. This is my third year with the Royals. And all the guys were looking at my. This is back when the spike hair was in, you know.
Yeah, remember that.
I was using Dippity Doo on my hair. You know what Dippity Doo is?
Yeah, remember that. They were going back.
And I walked in with spiked hair, and George Brett saw me, and George Brett goes, "As soon as our workout's going, we're going to the barber. I'm going to get my hair cut just like that." So George started spiking his hair. Because I started spiking my hair.
Wow. So see, you're a leader and he was a follower is what you're trying to tell me.
Oh, you know, on a winning team, it takes a lot of leaders, man. You got to lead your own way. Number one, you got to do it on the field. And that's how you lead on the team.
Absolutely.
You go and you be the best player you can be. And that's how you lead. And that's how I think that our teams won here when I was in Kansas City. We had guys that led between the lines. Frank White was, I'd lock her next to Frank for a lot of games, and what a great, great player he was. He and George, you know, got them bronze statues out front of Kauffman Stadium, and I'm so proud that when I played here 5 years, I was the one that they called on to replace those guys, and it was not easy. It was an easy job, but you had to be a leader on the field, and I'm so glad I got a chance to do it.
Absolutely. Well, before we let you go, give us that website again where people can check out your stuff.
Yeah, Life Priority is LIFE, Life Priority, PRIORITY.com. And if you use the word America in the code, you'll get a 10% discount on your order. And if you have any questions, they can email me off that website, too, and I can help them with their health issues and regarding the use of dietary supplements. So thanks, Wade, and it's great talking to all your fans.
Greg, appreciate the time, and we'll be maybe we'll talk to you down the line later this season. How's that sound?
Yeah, be glad to do it, and you have a fine son, and I hope he becomes a great player. And I gave him those tips. Hope he can look forward to using some of them.
That sounds great. We appreciate the help, Greg, and thanks for the time, man.
Okay, thanks, Wade.
That's Greg Pryor, former Kansas City Royal member of the World Series team from 1985. Join us today on the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Dansville.